And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from the remnants of the Jalen and Jacoby studio in Los Angeles, where there is no memorabilia left on the wall. And I am thrilled to be joined by two friends and great writers who collaborated on what must have been an enormously challenging book called Basketball, A Love Story, which is sort of an oral history culled from our 20-hour documentary coming up. To my left, Jackie McMullen. To my right, Grantland brother, Rafe Bartholomew. How are you guys doing?
Awesome. Very well, brother.
And we haven't seen each other for a while, so yeah. This is a happy day for us, too.
So, I'm not going to lie. I had low expectations. And I had low expectations.
Try not to be offended, Zach.
I had low expectations just because it's very big. It's a very, like, if I dropped it on a table, it would make a large plopping sound.
Go ahead, try it.
And I just can't imagine, like, I don't even know what format all this material comes to you in, because the documentary is 20 hours, which means there's 60 hours? I don't know how many hours of
hundreds.
Hundreds.
It has to be hundreds. Jackie, you received the physical transcript,
which I didn't,
which would have been about 165 bound, I don't know, leather bound books that would have looked great on a mantle.
I'm having like a mini nervous breakdown right now at the thought of getting all of that and being like, okay, now you have to turn that into a 500 page book.
And I got them and my son was like, seriously, Mom? Really? You can't do this electronically, Mom? And you know what? Halfway through, he's right. I ditched them all and I didn't.
Really? Because I'm picturing, like, I want my whole room with the binder spread out and the whiteboard.
I tried that. I tried that. It's too hard. This book was hard.
It was, I used all digital stuff because when we began working on it, or when they gave us the transcripts, I was actually living in the Philippines for 6 months. So there's no way they're shipping a few hundred pounds of paper all the way to Manila so I could look at it. Digital stuff does help a little bit. You could, if you were looking for a story about some kind of subject in somebody's transcript, you could, you know, control find. You had some stuff like that. But we also made an effort to, like, read these thousands of pages because first of all, you feel lucky to even see them. You know, this is the primary source material of like the Dead Sea Scrolls of a sport of basketball.
So that's what this is. And it is literally an oral history of basketball from the inception of the NBA through the Warriors. And again, I was like, that's going to be a lot. And I don't know if, am I going to get sick of the oral history format? Like, when you get those 700 page oral histories, by like page 400, I'm kind of done with this. I took it to Croatia on vacation and I just absolutely sailed through it. And there are two things and then we'll get into the specifics because there's too much good stuff to talk about. Number one, one of the great things about doing a book with this kind of scope, I would imagine, now that I've seen it and read it, is you have so much to talk about. That right when one section begins to be like, okay, I'm kind of ready to move on, you do move on. There's like, oh, now we have an essay about Allen Iverson. I was about ready to be done with the 70s Knicks. Now we go on to this other thing. And just when you get people talking at length about their careers in a sport that we all love, there are just these little tidbits that come flying out of their mouths where you're like, I never thought about that. Or I don't think I've ever heard that guy say that. Or I don't think I've ever heard that guy say that about that guy or that, that's the, like, just stuff just inevitable. Like, you talk to enough, stuff comes out. So either one of you, let's start broad. Again, we go ABA, 70s Knicks, Warriors. What was your favorite section to work on?
Well, for me, was the racial discrimination and I knew a little bit about John McClendon, and probably most of the people listening to this right now are saying, who the hell is John McClendon?
That's a name. It's to me, before reading the book, it was a name that I was vaguely aware of.
Right. And I knew a little more than that. But let me tell you, by the time I was done with this, he's all I thought about. And for those who don't know, he's the one that invented the four corners and then taught it to Dean Smith. He's the one that really was the father of fast break basketball. He was an African-American who went to Kansas and was a student of James Naismith. And as we detail in the book, what he encountered while he was at Kansas included just, you know, a host of atrocities, including, because he was a physical education major, he had to take swimming. They found out a black man was taking swimming and they drained the pool because they were afraid the pool would turn black.
You have another story like that in the book where Charlie Scott, who goes on to a great professional career, is being recruited by schools in the South, and Villanova, as a recruiting tool, sends him newspaper clippings about lynchings in the South. Like that's negative recruiting.
Right. And so anyway, John McLennan is a hero, but, and I won't bore you with all the John McLennan stories, but you don't have to go very far back for the racial discrimination stories. There's a story of Shaq driving to a game in Texas, and there's a scarecrow hung in effigy with his number on it in Texas. And that's not that long ago. You have Julius Erving talking about how he knew he was in the South because he would cross the Mason-Dixon line and he'd start seeing signs for the Ku Klux Klan. So what these players endured, old players, we're talking Oscar Robertson, we're talking Bill Russell, all
those.
But those
are the famous, to your point, the Big O and Bill Russell having someone defecate in his house. The time that the multiple times that the Celtics played preseason games in the South or exhibition games in the South that Russell bailed on when he found out the hotel
in Kentucky
was discriminated. Those are all known stories.
Right.
The stories that you guys unearth are lesser known and frankly should be more known. What about you?
Well, I just want to talk about John Thompson in the chapter.
He's a star.
On race he stands out. So he has some quotes that sort of cut to the bone of just life and humanity in ways that I mean, doesn't really surprise you because it's John Thompson. He carries himself like that all the time.
Does he have a towel over his shoulder even in regular civilian life?
I could imagine it. I wasn't there to see it, but where he says, the biggest myth in America is the idea of equality. No man wants to make another man equal to him if he's already has something above, like a step up on that other person. It's a sad observation, but there's a lot of truth in it, and you see it all everywhere. So John Thompson was a really, really powerful.
What did he say? I don't want to be the same as you. I want to be better than you.
And he's like, me too. I want to be better than you. Yeah. I'm not trying to be just as good. The part of the book that I really, really loved working on was a chapter that sort of strings together the older Olympic history of U.S. basketball. So starting in 1960, then 64, 68, and 72, the Hank Iba era, basically.
Didn't end well for Hank Iba.
No, it didn't
end
well for him,
by the way.
He sounds like a miserable dude to play for.
Doesn't he, though?
And Bill Walton puts it really well in the book where he's explaining why he didn't play in 72. And he's just like, this is not what basketball was about to me. Basketball is about love and freedom and expression. And Hank Iba had us play, holding, they actually had to play with the passing rule. You had to pass
the Hoosiers rule
three or four, five times before a shot could go up. That's unbelievable that it happened in real basketball. And at that level with great players, and they're sending, and the year that he in 64, 68, when he sent home Calvin Murphy, Pete Maravich.
This is the Olympic
Rick Mount
team in 68. You have the story in the book. Hank Iba is coaching that team. They pick the 12 guys. They go to Hawaii for training camp, I guess. He makes them all stay in military barracks in one room, a 12-person room, and puts them through these workouts that are so grueling that Sven Nader, who people probably don't know, was one of the best players on the team, just up and quit the Olympic team. Screw this. I'm out. 68 Olympics is John Carlos and Tommy Smith.
Right.
This story blew my mind, and I'm apologies if it's known, but you have some of the 68 Olympians in the book talking about how they watched John Carlos and Tommy Smith. And they say to themselves, if we win, we got to do something.
Right.
And one of you tell the story. Who comes to talk to them and what do they do to this person?
So the U.S. Olympic Committee brings Jesse Owens.
Jesse Owens!
To deliver the message to the sort of respectability politics message of, you can't do this. This is, the Olympics is too big for this. You shouldn't protest. And it's Charlie Scott telling the story, and he's talking about how he regrets now how angry it, of course it made them angry. It's very easy to understand how that message, especially coming from an icon like Jesse Owens, what he meant to the world and race in America, telling them now that they shouldn't make their own stand. You can understand where his anger was, but he's also looking back in hindsight and saying he regrets it. They booed him.
They booed him live. We booed Jesse Owens. 12 dudes just boo Jesse Owens in a private room. That's insane.
It's insane.
And then Charlie Scott says he, at the end of the tournament, he, he just left his jersey.
He threw it on the floor.
He just dropped it in the hotel room, hopped a plane back to North Carolina, and went back for his last year.
Charlie Scott's another one of those unspoken stars in this book. Some of the interviews, you know, some of them, I don't know if you found this, Rafe, but you'd go through them and I'd find myself glazing over a bit and you might pull something out. And then some of them, you could have used every word they said. I mean, and
Spencer Haywood.
Spencer Haywood was one of those. Larry Brown.
Spencer Haywood's stories about Adolph Rupp are not going to win him any friends in Kentucky.
Well, there's a lot of stories about Adolph Rupp.
Probably not revere Adolph Rupp anymore. Do they still have the thing named after? Do they have the court named after him still?
Rupp Arena?
That should probably not be a thing.
That brings us back to John.
Boy, this is going to be an unpopular podcast in Kentucky.
That'll bring us back to John McClendon. So Adolph Rupp, there was plenty of evidence that he was a racist. I mean, he was quoted calling at the halftime of the Texas Western games, "Don't let these coons beat you." All sorts of things. And one of the things that I found fascinating was a guy named Ben Jobe, who had played for McClendon, went to visit him. And he walked into McClendon's office and there was a white guy and McClendon with his back to him. McClendon said, "Hey, I'm busy. Come back in a little while." And so Ben Jobe waited an hour, came back, and whoever the white dude was gone. And Ben Jobe said, "Who was that?" And McClendon said, "Now, you can never speak of this to anyone. That was Adolph Rupp. That was Kentucky coach Adolph Rupp. I was helping him out with some basketball strategy, but he doesn't want anyone to know that an African-American coach was helping him." Now, this is a guy that was a known racist, yet he's going to McClendon for help. So,
two things on the race topic, and just sort of bringing back maybe disenfranchised or not appropriately remembered people. The name Cleo Hill is right. One of these footnotes inside any hardcore basketball fan's brain, if that.
Right.
Barely and remembered. He played one season in the NBA. He was a star at Winston-Salem State under Big House Gaines.
Right.
And you have Billy Packer, among others, quoted as saying, you know, "I walked into that arena." Billy Packer was at Wake Forest, is that
Wake
right?
Wake Forest, yep.
"I walked into that arena because I needed to see this kid play. And I thought, holy shit, this guy's better than anybody in the ACC right now." And there's no professional resume to speak of.
Well, that's because he was blackballed by his own teammates.
He gets to the Hawks, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the story goes, now this is the era where Bill Russell and others are speaking up about quotas and how we can
right.
only have three black players on the team and all of this. And even you have some of Wilt's white teammates in the book, one of them saying, I knew why I was on the team.
Yeah, like, Joe Rutcliffe.
Yeah, I know.
He didn't with just why he left. He didn't. They offered him the spot,
his wife guilted him into it.
And he's like, "No, I'm not." Yeah.
So Cleo Hill, I would watch a documentary just on Cleo Hill. I believe he was featured in Black Magic.
He was prominently featured in Black Magic. And we should mention, by the way, that this book is only made possible because of Dan Cloris's documentary. This was Dan Cloris's baby, and our book was born from his wonderful documentary. It's really important to say that.
Yeah, I mean, without that stash of interviews, this incredible sort of once-in-a-lifetime.
Yeah, I probably should have said that at the beginning.
We're saying it now. I'm saying it a million times. Yeah, we will.
And he deserves every
one. He's about to go on like a year-long awards tour, so it's going to be okay for Dan Cloris.
Yeah, we wouldn't worry about
that. But Cleo Hill goes to the Hawks in the 60s, is clearly the best player on the team, and the other players, so the story goes, are like, "We don't want this black dude can't be the best player on our team. Let's get him out of here."
Well, more importantly, it was the owners in the front office that were saying that, because they said if a Negro is the leading scorer on our team, we won't get any fans. Incredible.
And he gets a decent amount of space in the book, and I'm glad he deserves it. Listeners, 23andMe is a DNA testing service that can offer insights into your ancestry, health, wellness, not just the ancestor DNA stuff, but wellness and personal traits. The 23andMe Health and Ancestry Service includes reports on how your DNA can influence your weight, sleep, caffeine intake, sense of taste, whether you're likely to be lactose intolerant, all that stuff that we really need to know. And it's easy to do. All you got to do is spit into a tube that is provided in your 23andMe kit and mail that saliva sample back to the lab to be analyzed. 23andMe features something called the bitter taste report, sweet and salty reports, because DNA can play a role in what kind of food you like and don't like. It also features really cool sleep reports, like the deep sleep report tells you if you are more likely to be an especially deep sleeper. It sounds tremendous to be an especially deep sleeper. The sleep movement report tells you how much you're likely to move during your sleep, which would also kind of be cool to know, because you don't know what the hell's going on when you're sleeping. Order your 23andMe Health and Ancestry Service Kit at 23andme.com/low, L-O-W-E, my name, the name of this podcast. That's 23andme, 23andme.com/low. Low, L-O-W-E. The other piece that I'm glad you guys devoted so much space to are the point shaving scandals of the 50s and 60s, and in particular, what it did to Connie Hawkins, yeah. who was, and Roger Brown and Doug Moe, but really Connie Hawkins should be like a Dr. J level household name and instead lost 6 years of his prime. I know that Eddie Espin were having, you know, discussions about like, how do we sell a movie to our viewers that's so much about the 50s and 60s, but like that is a riveting story that has to be told. Like what happened to Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown is so wrong, and you guys really bring it out in the book.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned he could have been Dr. J before Dr. J. I mean, Dr. J tells a story in the book about he first learned about Connie Hawkins when his junior high coach sees him pick up the ball, he's got, and sees his hand and says, "Hey, little Hawk." He says, "Well, who's Hawk?" "Oh, that's Connie Hawkins. He's got the same big hands as you." So that, I mean, it's there.
Yeah. And so for those who don't know, Connie Hawkins was a great high school player from New York City. He was going to go play in college, but before he ever got a chance, he got a call from the DA's office. He had to go back to New York City. He had no idea why. He was interrogated, left in a room for—
That's not an exaggeration. He was interrogated.
Yeah, for 3 days. Not able to
sweat it out.
I want to call my mother.
Because known
Jack Molinas. Jack Molinas.
A mob associated.
Right. So
person.
Jack Molinas was a point shaver. He actually played for the Detroit Pistons and got banned from the NBA because of his point shaving.
Yeah, that'll do it. That'll get right. you banned.
And he was in prison. He was in prison at this time. And there was no question that Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown were seen with Jack Molinas driving around in his convertible. Everybody saw him in the summertime. Right. And Connie Hawkins is the first to admit that Jack Molinas would give him money from time to time, pocket money. He did borrow some money from Jack Molinas when he got his advance on his student loan, his scholarship money, and went home as like a big spender and spent it all and then realized, oh my God, what have I done? And needed to borrow, I think it was $200 from Molinas. Paid him back, went back to school. His brother repaid the loan for him. So the idea of Connie Hawkins shaving points, he hadn't played a game yet. He hadn't played a college game yet.
And he'd never lost a high school game.
He'd never lost a high school game. So how on earth could he have shaved points? So the star, another star who's since passed, I'm sorry to say, Roz Littman, his attorney, I thought was fantastic.
Unbelievable in the
book. She was unbelievable. And she has since passed. And by the way, Connie Hawkins has since passed. We were fortunate enough to have his interview in this book as well. But my favorite part of this whole Connie Hawkins thing was when this attorney, Roz Littman, and her husband decided to try to, exonerate Hawkins. One night her husband came home and he said, "Well, we're going to interview Jack Molinas tonight." She said, "Oh, so we're going to prison?" He said, no, we're going to a restaurant." He's in prison. So they show up at this restaurant. They're waiting for this Jack Molinas. He comes in. He's not in prison garb. He's got a girl on his arm and two guards from the prison standing there watching him eat dinner with Roz Littman and her husband. And then they took him back to prison after the interview was over. And in that interview, Molinas said, I never asked Connie Hawkins to shave points. I never asked him to do any of that.
Well, it's this nightmare kind of situation that we sort of associate with documentaries about, injustice in the legal system and cops sort of sweating confessions out of people, sort of kids they pick up off the street, like basically bad policing of minority communities.
Yeah.
You don't think that even, yes, of course, these are black basketball players. Doug Moe is white, but you don't think of this happening to great athletes. You think, it's not going to happen to someone on that level, but that's exactly what they did to Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown and the rest of the players, many of the other players caught up in this whose lives and careers
Ray Poplawski, his career ended before it started.
So you and I were just at the Hall of Fame, and the undisputed winner of Hall of Fame Thursday and Friday was Don freaking Nelson.
Oh, he was
who showed up in a black t-shirt and a black blazer and a big gold chain and slicked back hair and a goatee to the point that I was like, is that Don Nelson?
And he was wearing flip-flops.
And flip-flops, because Don Nelson has won life.
Grand Slam home run.
And like everybody at the Hall of Fame was like undisputed winner of the Hall of Fame. So I did not know this story in the book.
Neither did I. In fact, I asked Nelly about it at the Hall of Fame first we should tell.
Well, this is, you want to know what like, we talk about sacrifice and guts and hero. Mm. This is like an actual instance of guts. So Connie Hawkins is suing to get into the NBA. The NBA has banned him.
And by the way, a lot of years has passed.
Yeah, he's 26, 27 years old, whatever he is now. He's suing. And part of the way that what he has to prove to win is that he is good enough to play in the NBA, which is like, duh, it's Connie Hall, because right. everybody knows this. But the NBA is trying to argue just because this is what institutions do. They just dig their heels in and argue. They're trying to argue he's not. And so Connie Hawkins approaches Don Nelson. How do they know each other?
Oh, they Pittsburgh. He played, yeah.
Nelly grew up around Pittsburgh, and so Connie Hawkins played in the early ABL and then the ABA in, right. with the, for the Pittsburgh franchise there, and they sort of met.
They were good friends. Yeah. They had a really good friendship.
So he asked Nelly, "Hey, can you testify for me? Like, you know, I can play." And Nelly's like, "Of course."
Yeah.
And then he tells some of the NBA sort of fathers that he's going to do this. And all of them, including Red Auerbach, I believe, right?
Right. Gets a call. Actually, he didn't tell the anybody, but somehow Red Auerbach found out he was going to testify.
Oh.
And maybe he was on a list.
Right.
I guess he was on
the
list. And so Auerbach pulls Nelly in and says, "I'm telling you, you can't testify for Connie Hawkins." He goes, "Well, all I'm going to say is he belongs to the NBA." He said, "I'm telling you, if you do that, your career is over.
Your career is over.
Your career
you're
is over.
You're Don Nelson. You're going to be blackballed from the NBA.
Your career is over." And Nelly's like, "Red, I got to tell the truth." He said, "I'm just telling you, your career will be over." And Nelly, of course, was very fortunate that the case was settled before he ever had to make that decision. But now you got to fast forward to 2 weekends ago. I see Nelly. Didn't recognize him at first.
Unbelievable. He literally is like, he's a pretty recognizable dude.
He's just the greatest guy ever. And so I said to him, "Nelly, I just want to, he had gotten the book. He told me he had read it. He enjoyed it. I said, you had the most important quote in the book, in my mind, about, Connie Hawkins and Red." And he said, "Didn't you ever wonder why Red and I, cause I always did wonder what happened with them. That was one of the reasons." The other thing Nelly said to me, which was interesting, postscript, was, I said, "So why do you think they were targeting Connie Hawkins?" And he said, "Because I truly believe he was going to shave points. He didn't, but he probably was going to." Isn't that interesting?
It's like Minority Report. Like, yeah. You're probably going to do this in the future. We're going to come get
right.
you now. All right, flash forward in history. One of you give me another section of the book that's like since the 70s that you especially enjoyed putting together.
Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good one.
And we didn't have an interview with Jordan, but there were so many great stories from people who played with him, David Falk, his
first
agent.
First of all, can MJ give an interview?
He's doing his own documentary.
That's right. That, you know what? Still.
That's why.
Okay. Anyway.
So one, it was sort of a fun, editor problem, and I don't want to get too gearheady about this in the podcast, but it was fun to try and figure out how to tell this story about Michael Jordan without having anything straight from his mouth. And there are just a couple of stories about him that stick out for me that are just some of my favorites in the book. Billy Packer tells a long, almost, it might be the longest single quote in the
book.
It's a full page. Yeah. About Bob Knight and Michael Jordan on the 1984 Olympic team. I was 2 years old at this point in time. I didn't know anything about this team really. Bob Knight didn't want to pick Jordan on this. He was coaching the Olympic team that year. Didn't want to have Michael Jordan on the team because.
What is with these Olympic coaches?
It's power, man. It's a power trip.
He says, "I can't have a two guard who can't shoot."
Yeah, they thought Michael couldn't shoot.
Right.
Bob Knight had it in his head because in the tournament that year, Indiana had beaten North Carolina by forcing Michael to shoot from outside, and Jordan had an off night. So he's, of course, Bob Knight will run with that for, once you have confirmation bias, you can live on off that for a long time. Anyway, he says he doesn't want him on the team, but he has to take him, of course, because he's Michael Jordan. And then Billy Packer keeps meeting up with Bob Knight as they get further and further closer to the Olympics. And every time he sees him, it gets better and better. He's like, "Well, I'm still not crazy about the shooting, but the guy, he competes. He's a real foxhole guy. I'd go to war with him any day." Then
we need to retire foxhole. we just need to retire that.
We need to retire Bob Knight. Well, I guess we already did that.
Yeah, that's.
And so then they embark on this exhibition tour of the states. And this blew my mind too. Just this fact that the team of college players played 9 consecutive games against NBA, NBA selections. Some were all-star teams. Some had.
Oh no, they were really good.
They're good NBA
teams. So I'm a young writer covering some of this.
And this team with Michael Jordan, Chris Mullin, Patrick Ewing, they beat them. They went 9-0 against the NBA in these
games.
They
were annihilating the NBA.
Anyway, when you read about those, see, I had forgotten about that. It's like the version of the Dream Team scrimmages from 92. Right. Like, I had just forgotten about it. Boy, would you love to see a video of those games.
Yeah.
Like,
unbelievable.
And by the end of that exhibition tour, Bob Knight comes back to Billy Packer and he says, he's going to be the greatest player of all time.
Yeah, it's in my notebook. This guy is going to be the greatest player who ever lived.
Right. Everything about Jordan, the way he signed with Nike, it's a great adventure that we detail. But even the vintage Jordan years and, you know, we do have Steve Kerr in the book talking about his clashes with him. And even Jordan at the end of his career, one of my favorite mm-hmm. parts was Doug Collins. So Doug Collins is coaching Jordan at the end in Washington. And, I think, I forget what the streak was. Help me out, Rafe. Was it a certain amount of 20 point games or?
Double digit points.
Okay.
Scoring.
Something that simple. And, he's playing on a bad Washington team. So they're losing and Doug Collins looks and I don't think he really realized at the time what was at stake, but he's like, well, I'm just going to take him out. So he took him out. And that, you know, the next day Jordan says to him, do you really think I'm no good anymore? Do you think I don't have it? And Doug Collins is like, no, I don't think that. I just thought, you know, we weren't going to win the game and really know. So the next game, Jordan goes out and he goes, you leave me until I tell you to take me out. This is what he says to Collins. So he goes out and he just goes bananas, scores like a zillion points. And Doug Collins is like, and he's like, nope, not coming out. Nope, not coming out. And for like the next three games, I think he averaged like 25 points a game.
Wait, he scored 51 and then 45 in the next two games.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it had been, it became a big story before that because he had 8 points and Jordan hadn't scored under double digits in like over a decade or something.
Yeah, it was just crazy.
And there were, you know, the media jumped on it and Jordan turned around and yeah, he dropped 96 in the next two.
Yeah. And that's just Jordan in a nutshell. Just killer.
Listeners, you know, I love anything that can save me time, and buying tickets to sporting events or comedy shows or plays or whatever was one of those things that a few years ago was starting to take up too much of my time. There's so many sites on the secondary market you have to search. Am I getting a good deal? Oh my God, did I forget to check that site? All of a sudden an hour has gone by. SeatGeek has solved all those problems. It collates that entire secondary market into one place. It organizes all those tickets into a very user-friendly system, color-coded with green dots for good deals and red dots for bad deals. Every purchase is fully guaranteed so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. And best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the SeatGeek app. Enter promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. That's promo code LOWE. And you get, bam, $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event, and we have the tickets. I'm going to read you guys some quotes, some of my favorite quotes. I pulled out some of my favorites, and one of you has to tell me who said it, and then we can riff on it. Okay. This I really liked. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's left leg belongs in the Hall of Fame. Who said it?
Bill Walton.
No, I think it's
Robert Parrish.
I was
going to
say Parrish, yeah.
But you know what? Bill Walton said it too. Honestly, Bill Walton said it as well. So we used Robert Parrish.
Give the context.
Well, so the Chief was an ad for the book, actually. Someone that we just thought we needed a little more.
Ad meaning he's not in the documentary.
He's not in the documentary.
And let me tell
you,
people think of Robert Parrish justifiably as a grouchy, soft-spoken.
Very smart man.
But he is awesome in the book. I mean, I like every quote is gold. I'm like, damn, I want to go interview Robert Parrish.
Yeah, he's a very insightful guy and he's had time to think like so many of these guys. And he had great reverence for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And the context is the 85 championship when the Memorial Day massacre, the Celtics just slaughter the Lakers in game one and Kareem looks old and done basically.
See, that's the part I forgot about the Memorial Day massacre. Because you just, in the retelling of that final, you just sort of Memorial Day massacre game too. But yeah. Like, there were 4 days between games.
A lot of
time. And like, as if it were today with these daily talk shows and blah, 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 people are just hammering Kareem. Like,
they are
washed up.
He's done.
He's done. And then.
Right. And so Kareem, of course, is saying to Pat Riley, who's the coach, beat the crap out of me, bring me out. And, the day of game two, no one's ever allowed on the Lakers bus. It's a family only. Riley's an old school coach that way. All of a sudden he says, he's, you know, Jabbar's late. Riley's looking at his watch. He's like, damn, I don't want to have to find this guy before game two. 2 minutes to spare. Kareem runs out and there's someone running behind him and it's his dad. And he turns to Riley and he says, do you mind if my dad comes on the bus?
Mm-hmm.
Now Riley's got a problem because he's always told everybody, you know, this is failing. And then he's like, well, in his head, he's thinking rules are made to be broken. He puts Kareem in the front with his father. Everybody knows the rest. Kareem goes on. It's just dynamite in that game, just a monster all the way through the series. And Parrish said in our book that after that game won, he actually felt sorry for him because he could picture himself in that role. He could picture any aging player in that scenario. And he knew that the guy, because of that left leg belonging in the Hawthorne, the way you push off when
that's the push off leg.
So, and Bill Walton actually said the same thing, but I think we decided to use Parrish because Walton appears all through the book, and this was really the only place that Parrish appeared.
And Parrish has guarded him in that
Parrish
series.
Has guarded him in that series.
He's eaten those, the other side of, Kareem's.
Riley calls game two of the 85 finals, quote, the most important game in the history of our team. Because
he saved his career.
He said, when you dip into these little things, like I'm 8 years old when that happens, but I've read a lot about that. I just don't have it in my brain that, if they lose that series, Riley's fired.
Because,
and
as
who
he
knows
says
what
in the
happens
book,
after
as
that.
As he says in the book, they choked in 84. And that's a direct quote from Pat Riley. They choked in 84.
Well, Riley thinks they choke anytime his team doesn't win. He thought that he choked.
But he's right. They did choke.
No, that was Tragic Johnson. That was Gerald
tragic
Henderson
magic.
Steal. That was all of that.
Magic dribbling out the clock, remember?
So if they lose 85, then 86, they didn't make it. Now, who knows? You can't just extrapolate like that. But like, Riley, it's interesting to think about. Okay, I have to include this one. Honestly, I'm going to include the less obvious one because my favorite quote from this person is too obvious. This person talks about hitting a game-winning shot in a college basketball game. That's the only clue I'll give you. And says, and recounts turning to the opposing crowd and says, "This is my fucking house," which I probably didn't have to say because they already knew. Who is it?
That would be Diana Taurasi.
The GOAT. The baddest MF-er in basketball.
Another star of this book. She awesome or what?
Diana Taurasi is just a star, period.
She's my favorite basketball player, male or female, of all time. You know why? Because she's so brilliant and not enough people noticed, and it bothers me to no end.
You know, I have a long sleeve t-shirt that is UConn 3. That's her number. And when I wear
Babe Ruth, you know.
When I wear it, people are like, what is that, Caron Butler? Khalid El-Amin, who is that? I'm like, no, that's Diana Taurasi. Come on, it's Diana Taurasi's number. But this is an example of like you have maybe 15 pages on Pat Summitt and Gino Auriemma and the relationship between UConn and Tennessee, and it's just a delightful section. Can you guess what my favorite Taurasi quote is?
I got that fucking halter top.
Yes! She talks about the WNBA photo shoot. When she got there, she said, "I had a fucking halter top on. I never felt so bad in my entire life." Diana Taurasi is just the best.
And you know, she was right. And then Rebecca Lobo talks about how they had him leaning up against race cars in these sleek outfits.
Leather pants.
Yeah, leather pants and all that. And what the WNBA, to their credit, finally realized was, you know what? We're not sex symbols. We don't want to be sex symbols. Yes, some of us are lesbians, some of our fans are lesbians, but we also appeal to parents and to young girls and to fathers who have daughters. And we can be more than that, but let's be authentic. Because until we're authentic, this isn't going to work. And Diana was way ahead of the curve on that.
And those parts of the book, I mean, were just really important to us. And I hope people, take them treat it as seriously as we did, just because the three bigger chapters on the women's game, the early women's game, the early pioneers, kind of like the struggles that women had to go through, to Carol Blazejowski telling a story about how she tells this story about how she had to basically strong arm her entire high school into giving them a women's team. She threatened to play on the men's team if they didn't start a women's one. And they're like, I guess we got to give her what she wants. And Nancy Lieberman telling the story about going up to the Rucker Park and stepping out there,
stuffing stuff in her jacket to look bigger on the subway.
And saying, well, are you Mr. Rucker? And then he's like, no. He's like, well, then I guess I can play here. that was something, those chapters, are something that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see in the book in as depth as we fought to make these things happen. And I don't know, it's really important.
It is really important.
Related to that, I mentioned before, I'll give you some quotes in a second, but I mentioned before the sort of meanderings that you get people on. And one of my favorite interviews, no matter how many times he does it, in how many contexts, I could listen to Christian Laettner talk about the Dream Team all day long. And being the 12th man on the Dream Team, it's just fascinating to me. And he recounts in the book, just this is a little random thing that stuck in my head. He's talking about Charles Barkley. And, you know, Barkley was the best player for a lot of those Olympics on that team. That was like peak Charles Barkley. Yeah, he won the MVP in 93. Like, was coming up on that. And he talks about, you know, and we all think of Barkley as, you know, coast to coast, just running over people, rebounding, post up. He's like, man, Chris Flander says, I've never seen a guy who's maybe 6'4" protect the rim like Charles could protect the rim. And it's one of those things where it doesn't come out unless someone is sitting down and comfortable and talking about something they love, like Charles Barkley and rim protection. Like, you don't hear about it. And it was cool.
People forget what a great player Chuck was. And it's because he's such a larger than life personality now. And he has a lot of opinions and he's a TV star and all that. And he did change teams. And I think, fair or unfair, back in those days, it diluted your career because the league was all about start to finish, like Bird, like Magic, not like Jordan, because it didn't end up that way with Jordan, almost.
Yeah.
I like to pretend that Washington stuff never happened.
Yeah, we all do.
Right. But you know, Isaiah Thomas start to finish in Detroit, that was sort of a badge of honor. And so because Barkley changed teams a lot, I think some of that got lost. But one of the things Rafe and I talked about, and this happens sometimes, was one day I remember I woke up in the middle of the night and I called Rafe the next day. I go, do we have enough Barkley? Because you know, you start thinking, we don't want to leave these people out. And Barkley, of course, was the star of the Dream Team chapter, as he should have been.
Or he was the star.
I love the story, and I never get tired of hearing it, is when they said, when Barkley's coming down to shoot and it's Bird, Barkley and Ewing are coming down and it's Bird and it's Pippen and Jordan. They're like, yeah, championship basket only. You guys go down there. You know, that's great stuff.
I don't know anything about Angola, but Angola's in trouble. That's the best quote of the Olympics.
Exactly.
There was something else I wanted to say. Oh, and also about the 92 Olympics. This maybe is petty, but also maybe interesting. Mark Cuban randomly chirps about the 92 Olympics, and you have all these international players talking about how influential the Dream Team was,
right,
and Dirk and Pau Gasol and Tony Parker starting their career. And Cuban just out of nowhere pops in and is like, that's all horseshit. What happened was the internet happened and everyone could watch these guys play and technology changed and there were more ways to watch games and all of this. Like, forget the Dream Team. International basketball would have happened anyway. I just thought, well, that's an interesting thing to say.
Yeah, well, I almost was, when I was looking at it, I was like, is this too dickish to just drop in here like this? But as a counterpoint, it seems...
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Good. It's like there is... He's not... It just makes sense. It's a much bigger view than
it's
we're...
It's a businessman's view.
Right, exactly. He's looking at all of these big trends about for people around the world, regardless of profession and these things. And he's just saying, no, access to information got better, so people saw more of the sport.
He did. He interrupted our love story is what he did.
But it works.
No, it was fantastic.
Not as petty, although you feel bad calling it petty given the subject matter that we discussed earlier in the podcast. Not as petty, though, as Oscar Robertson saying the 1960 Olympic team could definitely beat the Dream Team. And all the Dream Team did was play one-on-one basketball against bad teams. It's like, okay, Oscar, just say the Dream Team's really good. Just say we're all really good. The 1960 Olympic team with him and Jerry West and a million other, they're all in the Hall of Fame. That's in the Hall of Fame too. Just we're both great teams. You don't have to sit here and say, yeah, all they did was play isolation ball.
Yeah. I kind of think we have to give the legends their just let them have their get off my lawn stuff.
Right.
It's never going to change. That was, I mean, the transcripts are full of great coaches and players from past generations. And they won't stop talking about how three-pointers are ruining basketball.
Right.
And just a lot of these arguments.
Of
well, yeah, it's just it doesn't serve any real purpose.
Although
include a lot of that.
One of them that I thought was somewhat valid was when Cousy was talking about how everybody from the Bulls, you know, people, when the Bulls started winning 3, 4, 5 championships, they started calling Cousy up and saying, so is this like the dynasty? Is this the greatest dynasty of all time? And he's saying, yeah, really? Cause like we won 11 out of 13. Call me back when you've done that. Click. You know,
there were a few more teams in the league when Chicago won 6 times.
So Cousy will counter with that because I just did an interview with Cousy.
They were stronger teams,
yeah,
right?
The elite
stronger
talent
teams.
Was concentrated.
Yep.
Okay, all right. You know, it's a lot of smoking on this.
Yes, it's okay. It's all good.
Which they talk about in the book, the smoking.
Yeah. Oh my God, they all smoked. Satch went to the Celtics, and he's like, how do these guys run up and down the floor all day? They're all smoking. Maybe I should start smoking. So
the best part is Tommy Heinsohn.
Yeah.
Where Red is like, Tommy, you gotta stop smoking because you get tired in every game. And then you stop smoking and he gains weight. And he's like, Tommy, you gotta start smoking because you're fat again.
And then it was Satch just telling the story of how they would try to, the guys would move up the bench when Heinsohn was in because they knew that Red was going to get annoyed with Heinsohn getting gassed.
Oh,
and then turn around and the first person he sees, he'd be like, Satch, Sanders,
go ahead.
Get him out.
Yeah.
This is too easy, but here's a quote that will give us lots of interesting places. I don't like the triangle either, but that must work because he's got six rings.
I know this one.
All right. It's about Jordan. Oh, is it Kobe?
Shaq.
Close.
Shaq. Okay, yeah.
Shaq up upon learning that Phil Jackson was the candidate
for
the
Lakers.
Right,
okay, yeah. I should know that.
Now, it feels like there shouldn't be any new ground to cover in Shaq Kobe, and there probably isn't, but boy, is it fun to read it over again.
It is. It is. They were great. I actually did the Shaq interview for this project.
Did you really?
I did.
He is, again, like you said about Barkley, has sometimes a little bit, I think, on purpose made himself a larger-than-life cartoonish figure. Shaq is very sharp in the book.
Oh, and he's so smart. And, you know, it's not in the book, but people forget that was Shaq. He hired a guy named Lester Nessel when he first went into the league that took – I don't know how much money out of his paycheck every year so that when Shaq turned 40, he would make $4 million a year for the rest of his life. Mm. Shaq is a very smart dude. And he's had a lot of time to consider the whole Shaq-Kobe thing. And there is a certain detente there. But the one thing I called shenanigans on, even when I was doing this interview, was the idea that this was all for show and it was all a good, you know, it wasn't.
Oh,
I mean,
they broke up the team.
Well, and the story about, you know, Phil Jackson finally said, the bickering, that's in the book. You two, enough of the bickering. I don't want to hear another word. And then Kobe went on and did an interview with Jim Gray, and Shaq went to the
– In which he calls Shaq lazy, out of shape, doesn't care about basketball as much as I do. And Shaq, you just said it, literally calls Kobe and says, I am going to kill you at practice. And they have to have like people ready to prevent this.
Yeah, Peyton and Karl Malone were on those
teams. Yeah, I guess it's a good thing Karl Malone is there because there aren't too many other people on the planet. I could imagine having any chance at slowing Shaq down when he decides to go after somebody.
Now, the stuff that was fresh to me either because it had escaped through my brain or something was Shaq talking about young Kobe. Rookie Kobe was really interesting. I don't know if you want to.
Well, one of my favorite stories about that was, so Del Harris is the coach. Kobe's jacking up shots. So Del pulls him out of the game because he's out of control and he sits him down. And Shaq very clearly remembers a guy coming down from the stands and saying, put the kid back in. And Del Harris has turned around and goes, I'm not putting him back in. He said, Dr. Buss says to put him back in. I had never heard that before.
I hadn't heard that. Makes me feel better because I don't remember that story.
I don't remember that. Yeah.
And Shaq says Kobe played and won street ball.
Right.
Only could get buckets for himself. Phil trashes his leadership. You know, Phil's trashed Kobe before many times over. But it was interesting to hear Shaq talk about him as this sort of young guy who didn't really get team basketball at all,
or even how to interact with your teammates. And Phil had some great quotes about that, saying, "Kobe, you want to be a leader, but you're not. You know, you don't ever talk to these guys." And he's like, well, all they talk about is cars and girls and music. And so, you know, feels like, well, try it out, man, because you can't, you know, you don't just.
Girls and music are like perfectly okay subject matter for young people. I mean, it's.
Exactly.
No, that chapter, unsurprisingly, is very entertaining from start to finish. Okay, here's another one. This is a guy talking about being in the training room at a game. He said, I think the guy taping me was a poultry farmer.
Well, that was from the ABA.
I think that's Larry Brown.
Correct. Yeah. So here's my question. Was the most agonizing part of the book picking what 40 pages worth of material to use about the ABA? Because as Terry Pluto shows in Loose Balls, which is a book everyone has, I would read five books about the ABA. The crazy story.
You're validating my friend Rafe here because.
You wanted more ABA?
Oh.
Well.
He got more ABA. He originally, so we would split up these chapters. We would, you know, we did stuff together, but we would take separate chapters, and the ABA was one of Rafe's babies. And he came back and said, you know, I don't know, what was it? We were supposed to stay to 6,000 words a chapter or something like that. And Rafe's like, this is not happening. And I was like, just go for it and let them cut it later. And of course, they didn't cut any of it. It was all so spectacular.
Yeah, we trimmed a little bit of it, but enormous. Yeah. I think, you know, we took some Kentucky Colonels out, which bummed me out because there's some good Hubie Brown stuff,
Hubie
Louis
Brown.
Dampier stuff that was
and really, John White Brown.
Hubie Brown talked.
Louis Dampier just got into the Hall of Fame a couple years ago, right? I believe Louis Dampier finally got
by the Veterans Committee.
Yeah,
maybe?
But yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Which was obviously long overdue.
Yes. Absolutely. So, yeah, the ABA is just, I mean, Brisker.
It's too good.
That guy was crazy.
It's too, the ABA crazy. Is too, it can't,
Slick Leonard.
If I could be like, go back in time and write about anything, in sports, I might go back and cover like the Flint Tropics for you know, like the movie team, or like, I guess I, if I had to pick a team to cover, I mean, the Pacers were like the closest ABA dynasty, and they're funny. Miami Floridians, that was an ABA, that would be a fun one. Yeah, Earl Monroe is thinking about signing with the Pacers. Goes in the locker room, sees three of the players put guns on top of their lockers, and he's like, you know what? I think I'm out. I don't think I want. And that's like the 19th craziest ABA.
And that was the most, that was known as the most stable ABA franchise.
Right, exactly.
Those were the guys that everyone was like, oh, yeah, no, those are good guys.
I love the story about like George Mikan. He's the commissioner, and he's the reason there's the red, white, and blue ball, because he was blind and he couldn't follow the orange ball. So he thought he might be able to see the red, white, and blue ball better. And then they have to paint it.
Yeah, they're not. Not ready, so they paint them and then they patent them, but they don't get a patent on the color scheme, so they make no money.
Zero money.
It's unbelievable.
And they've all got paint on their hands.
You literally can't be. You just couldn't make the ABA stories up.
Yeah, it's just
there was
crazy.
Another ABA story that I wanted to. It's just, but you bring to life those guys too, and you know, that's the ABA in all seriousness. Some of these guys we're talking about, Connie Hawkins, Spencer Haywood, they were the league that said, okay, the NBA doesn't want you. Come play here, make money, have a career.
Well, I think Michael Goldberg, who's also since passed, you know, really very clearly explained how they were just hanging on. Their thought was to never outlast the NBA. It was just to get absorbed into the NBA. And I think they spell that out pretty well.
And late in the chapter, it sort of comes in the more serious part of it, in that the influence the ABA had on NBA basketball, you have in bringing in opening up the game and you know, using the three-point, popularizing the three-point shot, having Dr. J and David Thompson, and the idea that this sort of more free-flowing game that really sounds and looked like the basketball we're used to seeing in the NBA now started there. And then when there was the expansion, merger, whatever you like to call it, bringing those players in, getting Dr. J and George Gervin into the NBA.
And Rick Barry.
Rick Barry. Yep. That opened up the game, and then you saw sort of start to see it become this the beautiful, athletic, high, you know, above the rim sport that we know.
A story that I just hadn't had forgotten again, or read in Terry's book and forgot. The what if of Dr. J going to the Knicks.
Right.
I don't think did you guys know that story? I don't think I knew that story.
I think Terry wrote about
it.
Terry's kind of like the master of the ABA.
When you go back to Loose Balls, like everything pretty much is in there, but there's so much basketball, man. They're great.
Great
details.
You spin on everything.
That just slip your mind. So
correct me if I'm wrong. The Dr. J story is this. The Nets get absorbed into the NBA. They have to pay some sort of territorial indemnity to the Knicks, which is like $4 million. They are then broke.
Right.
They can't pay Dr. J's salary. And I couldn't quite get specific handle on it, but the story is essentially, if the Knicks in that position of power had just said, well, just give us Dr. J as part of the deal, they could have had Dr. J, and they did not, and the rest is, well, the 70s turned out quite nicely for the Knicks, but
yes,
you know.
Yes, it did. In a weird sort of way.
Yeah. No, and that's essentially what Philly did do. You know, they realized the situation, paid up the debt, and then Dr. J becomes a Sixer. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned, Rafe, the echoes of the modern game in the ABA. One of the things that's so, you know, in our little NBA bubble, we talk all about the evolution of the game, and there are more threes and five out, and these rule changes to liberalize zone defense and blah, blah, blah. And those changes are real, and they happen over time. But then you go back and read, like having a lot of shooting on the floor is not like a new thing. So you read about when the Knicks put Jerry Lucas at center after Willis Reed was either out of the league or injured. I can't remember which. They had Jerry Lucas was a center who could shoot threes. And they talk in the book about how Jerry Lucas would pull Wilt out of the paint. And there were these teams that just couldn't do anything against an offense that had 5 3-point shooters. Like, this sounds a lot like a stretch five today. When they talk about the four corners offense, now that was partly a stalling tactic. It looks much differently. But the way the North Carolina players talk about it, it sounds like the Rockets, in that, like, we just spread our four guys over here, gave our best ball handler the ball. Now the Rockets would engineer a switch and all that before that, and just said, our best ball handler is going to get into the lane because you can't contain him, and there's not going to be anyone there because the four guys are all spread out. Like, that's like, there's, that's not that different from how the Rockets play.
But if you talk to any NBA coach, they'll tell you, we haven't invented anything new. It's all recycled from years and years ago with a little tweak here and a little tweak there. And I think that's true. I really do.
There was something else I wanted to talk about the 70s Knicks, and now I don't remember what it was.
Bill Bradley, Deflategate.
Oh, that was going to be one of my pop quiz quotes.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it's too late now. This coach had three rules. One, hit the open man. Two, help on defense. Three, the bar belongs to Red Holtzman. Mm-hmm. So it's like the quote. That's a good three rules. The hotel bar belongs to Red Holtzman.
I hope it was.
This is back when coaches were coaches and men were men. That's all you did on road trips was to sit and drink in the bar.
Boy, they did a lot of that, boy. They did a lot of that.
Well, do you have Slick Leonard, who's doing better now, I think, in Indiana, was the coach of those Pacers and called like a team meeting in a hotel or something. All the players like, damn, a team meeting in the hotel. They open up the curtain in the room and it's a fully stocked bar. So everyone get drunk. Yeah. That's coaching.
That's how Slick.
That's
rolls.
How you keep morale yeah. up over a long season.
I hope people who listen to Pacers broadcast now have a new meaning for Slick Leonard. So
the coach, the story is, I mean, I don't, this is probably in loose balls, but Slick Leonard trying to attack one of his players yeah. with a hockey stick. Yeah. I mean, that's a thing that happened. I don't know why there was, I guess there was a minor league hockey team there or something.
Slick was just, that's who Slick was. I mean, you know, the whole league was no, it was like no rules. It's like, I remember we went on Costa Rica on a vacation and I'm like, can we bring this beer on the beach? They're like, no rules. That's what the ABA was like. No rules.
Well, you got Mel Daniels saying, yeah, Slick didn't play around. I took one shot outside of the
physical
key.
Violence. Yeah.
And he got in my face and he's like, I will kick your ass if you dare to do that ever again.
And he would actually.
Yeah. Give it a shot.
He would actually do it. Yeah. There are just so many. I don't know. What's a tidbit that we haven't hit that you heard or read and thought, oh man, that's cool.
Well, I really liked our chapter on the decision with LeBron because that's certainly been revisited a bunch of times. But to hear David Stern say, I mean, you're taking your talents to South Beach. I mean, come on, you know, because he's never let his guard down about how ludicrous he thought it was. And the fact that he went to ESPN and to LeBron and to his people and just begged him not to do this because he knew what a huge mistake
it was. I think he says so much for our broadcast.
That's
partner,
right. Exactly.
About
what he
ESPN.
Said. Right. So I thought some of the way that the whole decision, and some of the early comments about LeBron, like some of Pat Riley's reservations about this player that he thought was going to be one of the greatest players of all time, how he didn't have it in him in his early part of his career to finish the job.
You know? And obviously we know all about, you know, we've seen Paul Pierce's playoff rivalry with LeBron James,
right.
But he has that searing quote about the decision and early LeBron. He's just like, no, we just thought this was some Hollywood BS, right?
Right. Yeah.
You can swear on the podcast.
I think we did because we had to because Diana Taurasi kept swearing.
Diana Taurasi, boy, I was the league office will tell you that even when Rashid was still in the league, the foulest mouth in professional basketball was Diana Taurasi. Even when Rashid Wallace was getting 45 techs in a season, Diana Taurasi's mouth was fouler.
I believe.
And again, the baddest basketball player on the planet. She can say whatever she wants.
She can.
You just said something that reminded me of something else. What did we just talk about?
We were talking about LeBron and the
decision. LeBron. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting to hear Paul Silas, who coached LeBron's
wasn't that
first
great?
Cavs team, tell us what Paul Silas said.
Well, so Paul Silas gets this kid. He's the coach. He drafts this rookie, and he's watching him play, and he doesn't really have a point guard, and he's like, I think I'm going to give this kid the keys to the car. And LeBron's just quiet. He just does his thing, plays. But everybody on the team is like, why are you giving him all this power? He's not good enough. Why is this team all about him? We don't want it to be about him. And he would say to him, if you don't embrace this guy, we're going to lose him. And by the way, you're the ones that'll lose because we're keeping him. And their egos just wouldn't allow him to do it. So LeBron was very, very isolated his first couple of years.
They did Silas told him, the players don't like you. The other players on the team don't like you, and you just have to be okay with that because they're wrong.
Yeah, they didn't like him simply because they were jealous.
Yeah.
It really was. So very humble beginnings for LeBron. You forget how long I forgot when we stringing it together. You forgot how long it took him to win.
Yeah.
You know? And it was because he didn't have anybody. I mean, it wasn't because he wasn't, although he had these weird moments. Like, everybody talked about him biting his nails on the bench, remember, at the end of that game in the Celtics series, and then the kind of weird disconnect against the Mavericks his first year.
He melted down in that series.
Yeah, he did. And I thought some of the points about you know, Dwayne Wade finally saying, all right, look, let's just make it your team. Maybe that'll help. And of course it did. So I thought some of the LeBron stuff, I think anything about LeBron is revealing.
Yeah. And he, I don't believe he did an interview with Dan, right?
Oh, he did.
He's in there.
Okay. Yeah. He's in there, but he's not super expansive.
From what I saw, our transcripts show that the active players, and it's probably not that surprising, are a little more bland and shorter in their interviews.
A little underrepresented.
And the guys who can sit around and talk for about, you know, their glory days for 3 hours.
Right. But Steph Curry, I thought, you know, some of the comments that Steph Curry had about how he was, you know, shooting and the art of basketball, I thought were pretty revealing. Kevin Durant talking about how when he fell in love with the game, he walked into the gym and hit a shot, and I think he said, and the skies opened up. Some of those things to me were, it was just, it is a book, we go up to the present, but it's, I mean, we're really, I think, trying to build up this love of the game to
now. Can I do another quote? Speaking of history and the importance of it?
Mm-hmm.
I had dog syndrome. You know, dog understands but can't speak.
That's Sarunas Marcellonis.
That's correct. Mm. He's describing his first year in the NBA and in the language barrier. And that chapter is cool too. And it's just cool as we're all diehards. We all know. But it's cool to hear them talk about Sabonis.
Right.
And how great Sabonis
he really
was.
Yeah.
Vlade says, I really believe he would be on par with Michael Jordan had he come into the league. And Kenny Smith said you'd be in the conversation with Wilt, Kareem, Shaq, greatest big man of all time.
No,
it's just, it's
that.
Cool to hear them talk about him like that.
I got to see Sabonis in the 88 Olympics. So he was damaged, but he was still unbelievable. And so by the time he got to Portland, he was really a shadow of himself. But these players, you know, even when someone's past their prime, they know what they're looking at. They know what the footwork is. They understand positioning. They understand aggressiveness. So even though that time in Portland was at the end of his career, they all understood his greatness. They really did.
We get bronze in 88, right? U.S. gets bronze in the 88 Olympics.
Yes,
that's Seoul. Is that Seoul?
Yes, it's Seoul.
And it's
John Thompson is the coach, and he forgot to add three-pointers to his roster. He took Charles Smith, not Charles Smith from Pittsburgh,
Georgetown.
Charles Smith from Georgetown, instead of taking guys like, well, I could name a bunch, but Dana Barros was one that I thought of immediately. So that you know, some of that lays at Big John.
Silver is Yugoslavia, right? Russia, Yugoslavia, I think is the goal.
Yes.
Goal
yes.
On that one. Mm-hmm. I would love to watch. So Sabonis, you got to see Sabonis up close in 88.
I did, and he was amazing, astonishing, and agile still then, though he was already
in
serious decline, but he was lighter then. He didn't weigh quite as much. And, to just watch him, he looked like Walton with the way he could pass the ball. And I think we saw some hints of that when he was in Portland.
Yeah.
So he was special. And just the reverence with the way everyone, you know, when a player is, you know, greatness, LeBron, Jordan, Bird, Magic, there's an aura about them that all the players, there's a reverence for those players that's just unmistakable. And that was true with Sabonis.
That story Kenny Smith tells about, I think they played on like in the 1985 Pan Am games or something, you know, not a tournament we remember very well.
Yeah.
And he says that, you know, David Robinson just could do nothing with Sabonis, like nothing, had no hope. And it's just, you start to put it together like, damn. And that was when he was, you know, running the floor real hard and like just blocking shots at the rim and still shooting from outside and passing and running.
Right. And incredible footwork. Just incredible footwork. Like when he was in the post in the 88 Olympics, I remember because I was a former post player, just watching his footwork. A guy that size with that kind of deftness and that kind of great footwork.
That, the other, in the international chapter, there's just some fun little stories in there that creep in. Like, I mean,
how about
Hakeem?
Hakeem. Yeah.
Hakeem being recruited and he, you know, he was supposed to go to St. John's, visit St. John's, Houston, and one other school.
He never got that far.
Mind.
Yeah.
Right. So in his first stop, he flies from Nigeria to New York. It's one of some cold time of year, fall or winter, steps out of JFK, feels the cold air, and immediately turns back around.
It's snowing.
Go to Houston.
He goes, I'm going to Houston. And then Guy Lewis isn't expecting him for 3 days. So he gets a call that this 7-foot Nigerian's at the airport. We better go get him. And of course, once they got him, could never leave town.
He talks about the origin. These are some of the, since we're running out of time, I'm going to list some of the tidbits. Like Hakeem talks about the origin of the Dream Shake, which is interesting. Allen Iverson
Very, very reflective.
Well, just a tidbit for me was the origin of the cornrows, which I did not. I'm not going to spoil that. I did not know that. Maybe that is common AI fanboy knowledge.
I don't think it is.
I did not know the reason for getting the cornrows.
He said his cornrows. He did it because it was just too hard to have his hair.
Well, you
done
spoiled
on the
it. I was going to leave it for the book.
Oh, sorry. I thought you meant you wanted me to say it. I'm sorry.
No, it doesn't matter. There's so much in the book we could spoil literally.
I thought AI was great, very reflective, and Stephen A. Smith, I thought, was really, because he had a great relationship with Iverson, was very, very insightful when it comes to that.
Well, that's fans are always going to find ways to figure out, to conclude that their team has been shortchanged by the media in some way. But one of the difficulties is there's just not enough space. And so one of the artful things you guys do is you have these longer chapters, and then there will be this like little interlude where this team or whatever doesn't quite fit. And there'll be like a 6-page essay about Iverson is one, the bad boys. So they'll continue to say that they get short shrift in the world. Yeah. The bad boys get one. The Spurs, again, they will get short shrift in the world.
But you know why? Because they didn't participate. So we tried very hard. I tried very, very hard to get Greg Pop, and he just won't do these kind of things. And I do think it's because he just doesn't think he's important. I mean, I really believe that. He just doesn't like to talk about himself or his role in the game. And of course, Tim Duncan followed suit. We have a little Tony Parker, and we have Manu's pretty good. Manu's in the book. And you know, his stuff about Argentina and winning their medal in the Olympics, and the ball goes missing. That's one of my favorite stories.
That's in my story about Manu that I wrote a couple years ago. It was, I don't know what they, that, is that in this book?
It was cut from the, that was the one chapter that we lost was 2004.
I didn't read that.
2004, 2008.
So the story is, you could read it in my Manu Ginobili story. A couple of players on the team get drunk.
Right.
They won't quite admit who it was, but I think reading between the lines, it's Nocioni and Carlos Delfino. And break into Manu Ginobili's hotel room where he gives them the key. They take the ball, go to the archery field because they think it would be fun to kick the ball as far as possible on the archery field, and it's gone. They just lose the ball.
Yep.
And so in 2008, when they win the bronze, Delfino gets the ball and immediately hands it to Manu and says, this is to make up for the fact that we got drunk and kicked the ball on the archery field in Athens all those years ago.
I think Sabonis lost their ball too for a while, didn't he?
There's the stories that Sabonis didn't show up.
He didn't show up because he was too drunk. That's
right. Like drunk in the athlete's village, courting and just.
Look, when your Olympics are over, like if you go to the Olympics and then your event is done and the Olympics are still going on, you should absolutely go full on like bohemian, drinking, whatever you want to do for the remainder of the Olympics. You're surrounded by young, beautiful athletes and you're young and in the prime of your life and you've just sacrificed God knows how much practice time to achieve the pit. Then go crazy. That's
especially
what you should
do. Especially for these European and South American teams that have defeated the United States in basketball and won gold medals.
And behind the Iron Curtain too.
And so the one Sabonis tidbit that cracked me up, and in the transcripts, the way it was phrased, there was no way to use it as a quote, but I put it in one of those little interstitial context paragraphs.
Interstitial, that's a very nice word.
He's a smart guy. Rafe's a smart guy.
In the Soviet Union, when they were still playing there, the sort of standard issue corner store, like small and large bottles of vodka. Small was Marshallonis. And large was Sabonis. So like you go in, I'll get a Sabonis. It's going to be a long day.
And now, this is just an observation. Even in a book like this that chronicles all of NBA basketball history, there are certain things that are just, like I said, are not going to get their their full treatment.
Right.
The 70s in the NBA, the early to mid 70s, they just can. Other than the Knicks are the only thing that ever like. And like the 75 Warriors, the Bullets, the Sonics that won it in 76, I think the Sonics won it. I don't remember which.
77
was the Blazers.
77 Blazers.
So it was 76 then. Cause 78 was Washington.
And it's interesting that we've just sort of agreed that, no one's really interested. Like, and I do think like, so as a result, I do think there are players that are great players. Like, we just don't talk about Dave Cowens. Dave Cowens, his name just doesn't ever come up. Even Rick Barry just kind of comes up in these ways. Wes Unseld. Like, Rick Barry comes up because he went to the ABA, and that was, like, kind of weird. And now he's, like, cranky and has a bunch of sons that do stuff in the NBA. Yeah. But, like, this whole era, because all these sort of random teams won individual championships other than the Knicks in the 72, like, we've all agreed to just forget about it.
No, it's true.
Like, JoJo White, he made the Hall of Fame a couple years ago, but, even Havlicek, like, prime half, like tail end career half, let's say, it's, the guys just aren't talked about. It's weird.
It is weird. And it's, you know, one of the things we struggled a lot with. Again, I, you know, when I woke up, do we have enough Barkley? You know, Collins was, that's someone I know and respect very much. JoJo White, I know these guys. I've been around them. It was hard. I think the colleges, there's going to be
Collins
a lot of
was
unhappy.
An MVP.
Yeah.
He, right? Like, he won an MVP.
Oh, I'm well aware.
He's probably
and, you know,
the
Tommy
most.
Tommy Heinsohn was the coach of that team. Tommy Heinsohn was a really, really good coach. He won championships as a coach for the Celtics. No one remembers that.
Is Cowens the most forgotten or forgettable or overlooked guy who actually won a regular season MVP in the history of the league? Like, I bet you
Tiny Archibald would argue he was.
But if you asked like random fans, name as many MVPs as you can.
Right.
As many guys who won an MVP as you can. I bet like 1% would name Dave Cowens, and they're all from Boston.
Yeah, it's probably true. But Tiny, I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's others. I just can't think of them.
I mean, so many. Half the MVPs have been won by like four dudes.
You right.
know, LeBron,
right.
Michael, Kareem, Magic, Larry. You know, they're not that many.
Karl Malone got his one. Bill Simmons is still blaming me for that.
He blames you personally?
It does. I wrote this big thing about how it was Karl Malone. I was working at Sports Illustrated. What do you want from me?
Anyway, look, this
Michael made that one right, you know.
Yeah.
This is too much. When does Dan's documentary come on?
October 9th?
Well, so it is, according to the press release, it is available tomorrow on I think ESPN Plus.
What great timing.
Is that true?
Yeah. It should be available in full tomorrow.
Than I do.
And then it's running in over the weekend, so the last weekend in September, it runs on one of the ESPN channels in two 10-hour blocks, like on Saturday, Sunday. And then in October, I think October 7th is the primetime debut.
You are really on the ball.
He is.
Trying to remember. October 7th is a primetime debut, and that's when it'll be 4 hours a piece. And is that weekly on
or? Every Tuesday or one particular night. It's either a Tuesday or a Thursday. They're going to run an hour.
So five straight weeks of 4 hours in a row.
Right.
The documentary is going to be incredible.
It is. He's brilliant. Dan's brilliant. And this was his baby, and
The documentary is going to be brilliant, okay? But there are some people who are just going to either – I'm going to jump in and out, or I'm just – how am I going to watch 20 hours of anything? Or some people just prefer books to television.
Hope.
This book, I just can't congratulate you enough, because it would have been very easy, I think, for this not to work. Like, just pick the wrong material, or it's ordered wrong, or it doesn't flow right, or there's too much of this to the – the book, I literally just sat on my wife's porch in Croatia and just, I just read 100 pages. Like, it just flew by. It's called Basketball Love Story, just like the movie. If you like basketball, you just have to get the book. It's no choice. It's like gonna be one of the definitive books about basketball, and you have to buy it. That's it.
Well, that's very kind of you, Zach. We appreciate it.
Yeah, man. I mean,
well, good work is good work. It's really good. So congratulations. I hope you guys enjoyed
it. We had fun. Plus, we didn't know each other.
I got to meet this great friend.
I have like this new great friend.
Yeah, I think he wins in that equation. I think he's luckier for meeting you than
I don't think so. We'll see. He's a young guy. He's got a lot. There's a lot more happening.
I think Zach's right.
So. Thank you guys. Basketball Love Story. It's tremendous. Rafe Bartholomew, Jackie McMullen. You guys are awesome. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having us, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.